Thank you again, Mr. Burrow. Part two. Today we are going to continue a series of sermons that we started, I don't know when I gave it here, a week or two ago, a series of sermons on prophecy. There will be at least two more, because I've finished part three and I didn't get done. So there's a lot to cover when you start doing an in-depth study of the prophecies of the Bible, specifically end-time prophecy yet to be fulfilled. Previously, in part one, we covered the four horsemen, the ride of the four horsemen, and what each of them symbolized. Of course, that was deception, war, famine, and pestilence. And then we talked about earthquakes in diverse places. And sure enough, like right on cue, there have been a couple of major earthquakes even since I have given that sermon. We talked about persecution and betrayal as we saw that all these things, the four horsemen and the earthquakes and all those things were just the beginning of sorrows. We went on to see what was more sorrowful than that was persecution and betrayal, even among family members. But the conclusion of all those things that we covered in the first sermon was, see that you be not troubled. For all these things must come to pass. So see that you be not troubled. We have to have an awareness of these things. They will happen. We also have to be aware that there will be scoffers who will abound in the last days. Not just having scoffers, but there will be an abundance of them saying things are going to continue just as they always have been. I mean, you know, they can say, well, I heard these things 30 and 40 years ago. Nothing happened. And here we are again, hearing these things. And perhaps we will have 30 or 40 more years to go, or 100 years. But perhaps not. Because, as we will see in a later sermon, we look at the fig tree, and it's quite ripe. Today, if you're looking for a title as we continue part two, the title is Kings, Abominations, the Mark, and Safety. We're going to start today by looking at the prophecy concerning the King of the South. And that, of course, is in Daniel 11. So if you'll start with me today by turning to Daniel 11, I hope that you are very, at least somewhat, familiar with this amazing chapter. It is a chapter that is filled with prophecy. Most of the book of Daniel 11 has already been fulfilled. But there is quite a bit that has not as well. Beginning in verse 5, we see several mentions of the king of the south and the king of the north having constant conflict, constant battles, one after the other. Now, in these earlier fulfillments of the prophecy, Egypt, under the rule of Ptolemy, one of Alexander the Great's four generals, Ptolemy is the leader or in control of the Egyptian area and is identified as the king of the south. And to the north in Syria, we have the Seleucids, north of Jerusalem, identified as the king of the south. And they are fighting all the time. The chapter here contains amazing details written hundreds of years in advance about things that would happen as these two dynasties battled for control of very strategic areas over the coming years. Now again, I mentioned there's a great deal of prophecy in Daniel 11 and an amazing detail of exactly how it was fulfilled. If you have not yet seen this, it's something that was made available first, that I first saw, clear back in September 1983 in the Plain Truth magazine. A lot of us remember that. Now, some of us still have those magazines available, the hard copy of them. But thankfully, to technology today, it's still online. And you can go to various websites and obtain that. Or, if you'd like to see a copy of the Middle Eastern Prophecy, where it describes Daniel 11 and what we're talking about here in great detail, I can provide a copy of that to you upon request. If you send me an email, I will send it to you. Or if you need a hard copy, let me know that as well. However, we are talking about future events in this sermon. Prophecy is yet to be fulfilled. So we are going to move ahead past that time to the time of the end, Daniel 11 and verse 40. Daniel 11 and verse 40, where it says, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. Well, all through the whole chapter, it's been talking about the king of the south and the king of the north. So they shall attack the king of the north. And, of course, the king of the north will now, they won't take it lightly, they will come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter the countries, these countries that have attacked him now, the north, and overwhelm them. Kind of unexpected. Whoa, I didn't know you were capable of this much force. So they were totally overwhelmed and passed through and enter the glorious land. Of course, that's speaking of Jerusalem in particular, Israel. And many countries shall be overthrown. It will be their end. But these shall escape from his hand. It mentions Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Of course, we have to know where that is, basically, in geography today. Where was it in the past? It's generally that area today. Most notably, the Jordanian area. And we can notice that name, Ammon, Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries. And then it mentioned in particular, one that will not escape is Egypt. Have we been watching Egypt in the news lately? And what's going on there? And what type of leadership is taking hold now in Egypt? And I'm referring to the Muslim Brotherhood. December the 28th, 2011, Mr. Joel Meeker wrote the following in one of his blogs, and I'd like to quote from it. It says, it is vital to remain aware of developments. Notice he didn't say, take this casually. You know, he said, it is vital that we are aware of these things. Developments in Europe, where a stronger European Union appears to be developing from the current economic chaos. That was written in December. How much worse has it become now that we're in May? And also in the Arab world, where an Islamic Union may also be coalescing. It's coming together even more. It is likely from these blocks that we will see the emergence of the strong men. By that strong men mentioned in Daniel, he's talking of the king of the north and the king of the south. We will see the emergence of the strong men mentioned in Daniel who will engage in a war that will ultimately spread around the world and threaten to extinguish all human life. Now that's a quote from Mr. Meeker. Now what needs to be watched very closely is the fulfillment of the West, if you might say, the nations of the West, the United States and so forth, a fulfillment of the nightmare scenario that these Arab nations eventually uniting, coalescing, we saw earlier, under the banner of what drives them together, what holds them together, what cements them together in a strong bond? The religion, radical Islam. So we need to ask, will we see, are we seeing, and will it be even more, an Arab Union of nations in the future? Do we know that will happen? Well, many commentators and news analysts, if you listen to them, they say that we are. We're approaching it. They call it Arab Spring, don't they? Psalm 83. This is not a new scripture for you. Psalm 83. I hope you've read this one. Verse 1. And it's kind of a plea here that we shout this out, that we don't remain silent about it. Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace. Do not be still, O God. For behold, your enemies make a tumult. Interesting word. Again, you watch the news stories, these video coming out of some of these countries, and you see the word used, a tumult. Chaos, confusion. Rioting, if you will, riotous behavior. A tumult, stirring up. Those who hate you have lifted up their head. Does it sound like arrogance there as well? And they have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together. There's unity there. Against your sheltered ones. And they have said, come, let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. They have consented, they have consulted together with one consent, and they form a confederacy against you. The tents of Edom, the Ishmaelites, Moab, Haggites, and then it lists all these other people from whom Arab nations of today have descended. for the most part. Now, what do we hear in our news today? Don't we hear certain Islamic nations, particularly we can think of the nation of Iran, calling for the total destruction of the nation of Israel? The headlines are dominated by these stories today. We see them all the time. These ongoing conflicts here in the Middle Eastern countries between primarily the forces of Islam and those of Western nations. There's a conflict, and there seems to be no end in sight. It's going to be more complex, more difficult, and more violent. These Islamic fundamentalist nations seem to be totally focused on imposing their way, their religion, on everyone. It's their mission to convert the entire world to Islam. And if you try to get in their way and stop that, well, that's jihad. They are willing to kill you if you get in their way. They're looking for their Messiah, if you will, in the form of the 12th Imam. If you've studied any of that at all, you're familiar with that phrase, the 12th Imam, the Mahdi, to bring Islam and bring peace to the entire world. President Ahmadinejad, in a website called allaboutpopularissues.org, he's quoted, again, it's allaboutpopularissues.org, it says this about him, quote, "The Shiite Muslim president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, is deeply committed to the Islamic Messiah, the 12th Imam, or the Mahdi. There have been many through the years claiming to be the hidden Imam, but Ahmadinejad believes, no, he's yet to come. He believes that he, Ahmadinejad, is to personally prepare the world for the coming Mahdi. In order to save the world, it must first be in a state of chaos and subjugation. Ahmadinejad claims that he has been directed by Allah to pave the way for the glorious appearance of the Mahdi. This apocalyptic," that's the end of a quote, but then the article goes on to say, "this apocalyptic directive includes some very scary proclamations." Well, I think that's kind of an understatement. We have clearly seen and established, I believe, that the fundamentalist Arab Islamic Confederation of Nations is not a real positive thing for Western nations. It can be very dangerous. If you've watched any of their videos or anything, they constantly are screaming for death of the Jews and death to anyone who gets in their way. Now, we read earlier, the king of the south is going to push at the king of the north. Now, again, we're not going to take the time to go into details to prove today who that is, but we do believe that that's the coming European Union of Nations, elsewhere in the Bible, known as the beast power. We know from history that the heart of this massive end-time power of the north will be in Central Europe. Now, we have seen in history, and I hope all of us read our history and know about it, the revivals of the Roman Empire. Remember what it said in Revelation 5, were, one is, and one is yet to be. So one is yet to emerge on the scene, and it appears by what we're seeing in the headlines today to be very close. We can see what's happening in Europe, and we keep hearing the term, the United States of Europe, is a term commonly thrown around these days. Again, it's important for us to understand these things if we're going to understand prophecy. Much of the history of the Middle Ages reflects the struggle for dominance between Europe, not just Europe, but a religion in Europe, Catholic Europe, and another religion in this world. We go clear back to the times of the Crusades, a struggle between Catholicism and Islam, or the Muslim world. Daniel's prophecy tells us that once this end-time king of the south has pushed at or has provoked in some way the king of the north, then the king of the north is going to say, that's enough. We're not going to take this anymore. Action is going to be taken, and they are going to swoop down on him with massive military force. And we read in the terms, you know, in there about the ships and the overrun and with chariots and all those things. But it will be a massive military force, and they will invade and conquer much of the Middle East today. Now, what exactly will that push be? What's the provocation? Well, we really don't know, do we? But we can speculate, we can wonder, we can think about it. Perhaps it has something to do with oil. Perhaps the world still does run on oil. Europe gets much of its oil from the Middle East. What if there suddenly was none? What if it stopped? What happens to the economies of the world? The economies of the world are in terrible shape anyway. You know that. What happens if the Straits of Hormuz are blocked, as has been threatened? What happens if there is some sort of a nuclear explosion in the Middle East? Or other parts of the world, for that matter? What if there was to be a major terrorist attack in Europe, primarily on certain religious sites? What would happen? What would an already struggling Europe do to save itself from total collapse in the wake of certain things like this happening? And Europe is already on the brink of financial collapse. What would they do to survive now? It's funny how people unite so fast when they are facing a common enemy, an enemy that threatens to destroy them. They will unify together to save themselves against that, even though the unification seems rather shaky, much like iron and clay wouldn't stay together very long, but they would unite in an attempt to fight against their common enemy. As we read it again, Daniel 11, verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north will come against him, whirlwind, chariots, like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen and many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. And he enters the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape. Again, who escapes? Edom, Moab, the prominent people of Ammon. And he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So regardless of what this push is, regardless of what this provocation is, the north says, I've had enough. They're not going to take it. And there will be a rapid response. It will be overwhelming, and it will be deadly. This event, whatever it is, may be the catalyst, as we've talked about now, for the culmination of these 10 kings uniting to join forces against this threat, because it will appear that their very survival is at stake. And they're going to have to take decisive action to finally defeat this enemy. And there will be dramatic military intervention in the Middle East. And we see in particular the nation of Egypt is targeted. What's going on in Egypt today? Again, we see though the lands of Edom and Moab escape. The prominent people of Ammon. What's the capital city of Jordan? We know what that is, Ammon. Why does Jordan escape? Is it possible that they are in some sort of cooperation with the north, the king of the north? Has there been a previous alliance made? Now, the Jordanians, just as a people, seem to be, and actually I believe they are, more stable, less militant than other Arab nations. You can safely travel there. We're having the Feast of Tabernacles there again this year. What was it, 7 years ago when we were there? We felt perfectly safe walking the streets of Ammon, Jordan at night, going out to get a pizza. And the people treated us as friendly and welcoming. Just good, nice people. We enjoy being around them. And the relationship continues today. As I said, we're having the feast there. Have you ever wondered why that is? Why the Church of God has had such a long-standing relationship with Jordan, with the royal family of Jordan that continues to this day? Well, I think that's interesting. Time will tell, and we'll refer to that in a moment later. Let's go to Luke 21. At this time, we're going to be seeing an event that's prophesied in Luke 21 and verse 20. Because Jerusalem will be surrounded by armies as the king of the north comes in and takes charge of this area. There will be likely not only the European armies, but peacekeeping representatives, military representatives from all over the world. It says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Again, the occupation of Jerusalem is a critical event in end time prophecy once we see that happen. And it will likely be under the deceit of peace. Peace has come to this region. We're just coming in now to protect the peace, not necessarily be expecting to see all-out war or all-out destruction of Jerusalem at this time. It will be a time when many peoples of the world will finally be saying, at last, problems are being solved. Someone is taking charge. We've got peace is coming to this world. So 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 2 is something that we should be familiar with. When we hear people trying to proclaim peace has finally come, our problems seem to be being solved. Probably there is hope now for all the economic problems to be solved. Everything is finally going to work out. All of our problems, all those that would threaten our safety and security, they have been dealt with. So peace is here. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 2, "For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say," not if, "when they say peace and safety," no, that's the time "sudden destruction comes upon them as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, they shall not escape. But you, brethren," so you see, this is talking to us. We don't want to be deceived and caught off guard by these events that happen and agree with everyone else. "Oh, well, look, we've got 100 more years for this work because everything's stable now, everything's taken care of. There's peace in the Middle East. All the problems are taken away. Peace and safety. Then sudden destruction, they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness so that this day should overtake you as a thief." So we have to be aware now of what the Bible says conditions will be like. We can't be caught off guard. This military presence around Jerusalem, again, as I said, a large peacekeeping force, immediately precedes an event that will happen in Jerusalem. It immediately precedes the stopping of the sacrifices. And then the establishment of something that might to other people seem perfectly normal. But to the Jewish world and to some of us, other people, it will be something that is quite frightening. We will see the stopping of sacrifices and the establishment of the abomination of desolation, as it's called. The Norse invasion, again, likely under the pretense of bringing peace, welcomed by the world. They'll seem to have the power to be bringing this about. But let's go back to Luke 21, verse 21. As we see this happen, as we see the sacrifice stopped, as we see this event happen in the temple that will be described by some as an abomination, by others it will be, "Well, this is what we need to do." "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled." See, it all starts to take place. All these events start happening. "Woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon the people." The parallel account, Matthew 24 and verse 15. Matthew 24, verse 15 says almost the same thing, but it adds a little bit more. "Therefore, when you see," and we will see, it will be something we're aware of, "when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place." So it will be a place that's considered holy by some. And it says, "Whoever reads, let him understand." What's that saying is few people will understand. But we who are reading it, those of us called by God to understand these things, will understand. "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let him who is on the housetop not go down and take anything out, and let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes." It's sudden, it's quick. "Woe to those who are pregnant or nursing in those days, and pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath." I don't know exactly why that's there and told that, but I've heard Mr. Burns say many times that's what he does. He says, sometimes we don't understand things, we just do what it says. So to summarize, when we see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, after the provocation and all these things are happening and they overwhelm, know that its desolation is near, and it will be a time near to be fleeing to the mountains for safety. Again, Matthew 24 shows us this desolation is the abomination of desolation that will be standing in the holy place. Now, this abomination of desolation that we're reading about here, this is not the first time that it's ever happened. It will actually be the third. Let's go back to Daniel 11. Daniel prophesied that a successor to one of Alexander the Great's generals would set up an abomination of desolation. So we had all those generals. And then sometime later, verse 31, Daniel 11, 31. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Now, why would they do that in the first place? It says, forces mustered by him, stirred up, called to action. And for some reason, they will defile the sanctuary, and they will take away the daily sacrifices. They're setting up something else. They don't want anything to do with God's way here to be worshipped or set apart as something to be special. No, take away those sacrifices and place up something that we want, that we will set up, that you worship this instead, not God's way, you worship something else. And place there the abomination of desolation. Now, this was, of course, we're going back to this original abomination set up by Antiochus Epiphanes, who at that time fulfilled the role of king of the north. At that time, he outlawed all forms of Jewish worship. Does sound familiar? Again, what do we know about history? History repeats itself. He outlawed Jewish worship and all their practices. He outlawed circumcision. Those things were forbidden on pain of death. You do these things that are Jewish and you die. Sacrifices were to be offered instead of to God, offered to various pagan deities, whatever gods they had. And then, in around 167 BC, he sets up an altar to the Greek god Zeus in the temple of God. An abomination. And if that wasn't enough, they offer on God's altar, they offer swine. Biblically unclean animals, other things besides swine, but of course it mentioned that specifically, desecrating this holy place. And as we can imagine, that practice was loathsome and abhorrent to the Jewish people who saw those things. This was the first fulfillment of the abomination of desolation. History repeats itself. So perhaps we should take a moment and see more what life was like for the typical church person, if you will, during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and the first abomination of desolation, to get an idea what things might be like as it's fulfilled again. So turn with me in your Bible to 1 Maccabees chapter 1. That's what they did in Hickory this morning. They laughed. Of course, this is from the Apocrypha. You don't have this. It's not the inspired Word of God, but I want to read this to you today because it simply gives a historical description of what happened during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and the establishment of the abomination of desolation at that time. It says, "Moreover, King Antiochus wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people." Hear what he's telling his kingdom. "I want us all to unite. I want us all to be together under one world government," you might say. "And everyone leave his laws." And so all the heathen agreed. All the non-church people agreed according to the commandment of the king. And yes, many also of the Israelites consented. What? Many of the Israelites consented to his religion, and they offered sacrifice to idols, and they profaned the Sabbath. They profaned the Sabbath. So easily they could give that up, couldn't they? Look at that. "For the king had sent letters by messengers unto Jerusalem and the cities of Judah that they should follow the strange laws of the land and forbid burnt offerings and sacrifice." You can't do your offerings to God anymore, not the way you have been. "Forbid them and drink offerings in the temple. And further, that they should profane the Sabbaths and their festival days and pollute the sanctuary and the holy people. And set up altars and groves and chapels of idols. And you sacrifice swine's flesh and unclean beast. That they should also leave their children uncircumcised. And make their souls abominable with all manner of uncleanness and profanity. To the end," to the result that would be, "to the end result that they might forget the law. And change all of their ordinances." Is this ringing a bell? "And whosoever would not do so, according to the commandment of the king," he said he should die. "In the selfsame manner wrote he to his whole kingdom, and he appointed overseers over all the people, commanding the cities of Judah to sacrifice city by city, And then many of the people were gathered unto them, to wit, everyone that forsook the law, and they committed evil in the land, and drove the Israelites, the church people, into secret places, even wheresoever they could flee for help. Now the 15th day of the month, in the 140th year, they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar, and they built idol altars throughout the cities of Judah on every side, and burnt incense at the doors of their houses and in the streets. And when they had rent in pieces the books of the law which they found, they burned them with fire. And whosoever was found with any book of the testament, or if any were committed to the law, the king's commandment was, they should be put to death. So if you had a Bible, you died. Certainly if you practiced what the Bible taught. Thus did they, by their authority, unto the Israelites every month, as many as were found in the cities. Now the 25th day of the month, they did sacrifice upon the idol altar, which was upon the altar of God. At which time, according to the commandment, they put to death certain women who had caused their children to be circumcised. And they hung the infants about their necks, and rifled their houses, and slew them who had circumcised them. Howbeit, many in Israel were fully resolved and confirmed in themselves not to eat any unclean thing, wherefore the rather to die, that they might not be defiled with meats, and that they might not profane the holy covenant. So then they died, and there was great wrath upon Israel. Now that happened. That's history. The abomination of desolation and the powers to the north. A second fulfillment occurred in AD 70 when Roman armies destroyed the city of Jerusalem. Once again, the temple and the altar were desecrated. We won't take the time to go into all of that, but again, over 1 million people killed in unspeakable torture and terror. This time, the temple building and the altar were all destroyed, not to be rebuilt to this day. What is going to happen this time? Daniel 12. We see another fulfillment of the abomination of desolation is yet to come. Daniel 12, verse 11. From the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. 1290. The Jews today are currently not offering sacrifices, which means at some point they have to be reestablished if they're going to be stopped. For sacrifices to be offered, they need at least an altar, if not the temple. They need an altar. What this end time fulfillment of this abomination that makes desolate will be has not yet been revealed. We don't know exactly what will be this abomination, but it says in verse 10 of Daniel 12 that when it's established, the wise will understand. Who are the wise? I think I'm looking at them. We will understand when we see it. And we're not told how long it happens, how long these sacrifices continue, but they're stopped. And based on the historical pattern that we've seen, something abominable, at least to us and to practicing Jews, if you will, it's something abominable to them. And we'll recognize it when we see it. So we are now looking for a reintroduction of the sacrifices. Now, many Orthodox Jews want to do this and preparing now. I read a news article about it just this week, as a matter of fact. They'd love to be able to do that. But it will be an earth-shaking thing when it does happen. It will not be taken lightly. So preparations have been made, but what could start it? What could be the catalyst for saying, now we have to do this? We have to start. Let me ask you this. How frightened are the people in Israel today? How would you like to live and raise your family in the nation of Israel today? How about down next to the Gaza Strip? Or up in the Golan Heights or wherever? How would you like to live there? Raise your children there. Go out and play, little kids. You know. there comes the missile. You never know when it's coming. They live in constant fear of that all the time. What happens if, or when, Israel comes to the point where they say, we cannot wait any longer dealing with Iran, and they decide to strike against nuclear weapons sites? Will this somewhat Jewish nation that has some practicing Orthodox Jews, will they remember their roots, and will they now make an attempt to turn to God and implore God to save them as they reestablish their sacrifices to Him? Save us, keep us, we're going to die. Again, keep in mind, when these sacrifices are started, it will not go unnoticed. There are armies all around. There are, you know, the news coverage is all around, and I'm sure Facebook and all those things will be going strong. At that time, it will be now all about control of the region. It will be about power. And we look for this man of lawlessness, who we talk about, to rise and to be the one responsible for stopping these sacrifices. He will not let this happen. And he sets up, in place of the sacrifices, his image or his abomination, whatever it will be. He's not going to allow these sacrifices to God or anyone who would claim to be God, because why? 2 Thessalonians 2:3 tells us that. This religious leader, who is now using signs and wonders, proclaims himself to be God. And that's in 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 3. I'll just read part of that. He opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself he is God. So all this is happening. The end of the fourth seal, the beginning of the fifth, the four horsemen completing their ride, the great tribulation now about to descend on this earth, which takes place immediately in between these two seals. Revelation 6 and verse 9, we have the opening of the fifth seal. Revelation 6. When he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God. Obviously, this is, you know, allegorical or an analogy type thing. We're not really seeing souls here. But John's seeing this in his vision. The souls of those who have been slain for the word of God, these are martyrs, for the testimony that they held. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And then a white robe, this is righteousness, was given to each of them. And it was said to them, rest a little while longer, until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren would be killed as they were. Another martyrdom, until these days are completed. So another great martyrdom of Christians is coming. History will repeat itself. It will not be a pleasant time. Terrible things will happen. Daniel 12. Let's address another topic we've already touched on here. And again, some of the timing. Back to Daniel 12, verse 11. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, once again, how long was it? There shall be 1,290 days, told to count 1,290 days from the time we see the abomination set up. And Daniel was told in vision that the words he had been given, he said, these words are sealed till when? Until the time of the end. Okay, that's in verse 9. So the countdown of all these days here, the end result, the final end of the days, is presumed now to be the time Christ returns. Verse 12, blessed is he who waits. Well, what blessing would we be talking about? Well, what's going to happen at Christ's return? There'll be a lot of blessings going on, particularly for us. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days, 1335. Again, we know verse 13 says Daniel is told he will rise to his inheritance at the end of the days. So these days we're talking about, they're all resulting in one thing, the resurrection, return of Christ. Back up to verse 6. And one said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? And then I heard the man, clothed in linen, who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven, and swore by him who lives forever, that it shall be. Here's another time frame. It shall be for a time, times, and half a time. 3.5, 1260, 1260 days. And when the power of the holy people has been, as one translation has, as will be completely shattered, all of these things shall be finished. There's been an end result again with the same common result. Return of Jesus Christ. So this seems to mean the end of these various groupings of days here. That is, we've got the 3.5 years, we've got the 1260, we've got the 1335, and the 1290. All coming to an end at the time of the return of Jesus Christ. Now, how does that all work out? What do all those days mean? Possible scenario, and that's all we're doing here. Possible scenario is there is going to come a time when the work of God in this age is over. It's not over today. We still proclaim the good news of the kingdom of God. We do our work as best we can. It has not stopped, but there will come a time when it says it stops. It is completely shattered. The breaking of the power of the saints, the cutting off of their public preaching, comes 1335 days before the return of Christ. It appears from this description, we will clearly know it's over because it's been completely shattered. However that works out, we don't know. But it will be impossible for us to continue as we have in the past. Things won't be the same. And I suspect this will be very close to the time when we're seeing the King of the South attacking the North, and then that swift retaliation and an advance on Jerusalem. These things happen quickly. 45 days later, we are now at 1290 days before the return of Christ, when we'll be told this abomination of desolation will be set up. When this happens, what were we told? Those who are in the mountains, flee to Judea, flee to the mountains. And then 30 days later, now we're 1260 days before Christ's return, the Great Tribulation starts. Time times the half time, 3.5 years. We know, again, the tribulation period and the day of the Lord, added together, 2.5 and 1, 3.5 years, 1260 days. The same amount of time that the church is nourished in the wilderness, in her place, for time times and half a time, 3.5 years. What's happening as all this takes place? There's so many things that happen, and a lot of them are simultaneous. What's going on near the same time? Ezekiel 5. Ezekiel 5, the prophecy of thirds. Verse 1. Speaking to Ezekiel, and you, son of man, take a sharp sword. He had to act this out. It was something he had to do. Take it as a barber's razor, pass it over your head and your beard, and then take scales to weigh and divide the hair. And you shall burn with fire 1/3 in the midst of the city. When the days of the siege are finished, you shall take 1/3 and strike around it with a sword. And 1/3 you shall scatter in the wind, and I will draw out a sword after them. You shall also take a small number of them and bind them in the edge of your garment. Then take some of them again, throw them into the midst of the fire, and burn them in the fire. From there a fire will go out into the house, into all the house of Israel. Now that seems pretty hard to understand. What's all this talking about? Well, it's a parallel scripture. It's in Zechariah 13 and verse 8. It mentions some of these things again about going through a fire and 1/3. Zechariah 13, 8. It shall come to pass in all the land, says the Lord, that 2/3 in it shall be cut off and die. 1/3 shall be left in it. I will bring the 1/3 through the fire, and I will refine them as silver is refined, and test them as gold. Now let's go back to Ezekiel 5. Now verse 11, and try to understand what this is talking about. Ezekiel 5, verse 11. Therefore, as I live, says the Lord God, surely, because... Now, what's the reason here? Why does this happen? Because you have defiled my sanctuary with all of your detestable things and with all your abominations. What's this world like? What do churches stand for? Not much of anything. Everybody does what's right in their own eyes. They shake their fist at God. You can't tell me what to do. You defiled my sanctuary with all your detestable things and your abominations. Therefore, I will also diminish you. My eye will not spare, and I will not have pity. Does that mean God doesn't love us anymore? Of course not. God defines love. But lessons will be learned. One third of you shall die of the pestilence and be consumed with famine in your midst. One third shall fall by the sword all around you. The four horsemen will complete their ride. And I will scatter another third to the winds, and I will draw out a sword after them. The work ends. Armies invade and capture Jerusalem. The sacrifices are stopped. The false prophet proclaims that he is God and sets himself in the temple as God. All this is happening. And while all this is happening, attention has turned to a couple of other specific nations. Great Britain, the United States. And there will be some catalyst, some trigger that gives the beast power an opportunity to have their way with a certain old enemy. Amos 5 and Isaiah 6:11. Amos 5 verse 3 and Isaiah 6:11. Just for your reference, we're going to turn to Isaiah 6:11. Shows us that about 10% of the people will survive the times that we're talking about today. About 10%, a tithe, if you will. Isaiah 6:11 says, "Then I said, Lord, how long? And he said, until the cities are laid waste, and they are without inhabitant." That's extreme desolation. That's punishment. And the houses are without a man. The land utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men far away, those who have survived, taken away. And the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. So it's a time of great desolation, of waste, of destruction. But yet a tenth will be in it. Again, hard to imagine a scenario in which this is possible that would so provoke a power, the beast power. How is it that these Western nations, so weakened, how is it that we are so vulnerable to such an attack as that, that it could take place in the first place? Well, I hope you're reading about our economy on the brink of total collapse. Has been for a while. It's up and down and up and down. It's just like we're on promises. Our debt, what is it, $16.5 trillion? I mean, it's impossible to pay that down. There's not even a way to do it. I want to read something from a website. Some of you heard of it. I know that Jeff Baker has talked about this website. It's called TheEconomicCollapseBlog.com. TheEconomicCollapseBlog.com. It's an article that was written a couple of weeks ago now. It has a funny title. The article said, "Read this before you decide that preppers are crazy." You know what preppers are? They have a TV show about them now, don't they? Preppers preparing for disaster scenarios. They go out and build their bunkers and have all the things. I don't think I'd want one of those. I'm living healthy and my neighbor sees me. How is it you're not hungry? That's it. This story, though, is about what happens if our trucking industry was shut down. We depend on the trucks, don't we? And the truckers? Quote, "The truth is that our just-in-time inventory and delivery systems leave us incredibly vulnerable to a nationwide disaster. You see, it is very expensive to hold and store inventory, so most manufacturers and retailers rely on a continual flow of deliveries that are scheduled to arrive just in time. And this significantly reduces their operating expenses. This is considered good business practice for manufacturers and retailers. But it also means that if there was a major nationwide transportation disruption, that our economic system would grind to a halt almost immediately. Once store shelves are picked clean, they would not be able to be replenished until the trucks can get back on the road. In the event of a major nationwide disaster, that could be quite a while. So what could potentially cause a nationwide transportation shutdown?" Well, what could cause that? How can our truck stop? Well, it's easy to imagine a lot of potential scenarios. Again, I'm quoting from the article. They mention a volcanic eruption, great volcano, perhaps, maybe out in Yellowstone, I don't know. A historic earthquake, well, the New Madrid Fault, you know, San Andreas Fault, a huge earthquake. An EMP attack. You know what an EMP is? Electromagnetic pulse, where they shoot this thing in the atmosphere and, you know, it disrupts the, supposedly disrupts all the communication, I mean all the computers. And they're suddenly all gone. All the circuitry is fried. A solar megastorm. That's been in the news lately also, hasn't it? Sunspots. A major terrorist attack. An asteroid strike. A killer pandemic. Mass rioting in U.S. cities. Has that been in our headlines lately too? If something caused the trucks to stop running, life in America would immediately start changing. Within 1 week, automobile travel will cease. Why? No gasoline. Without autos and buses, many people won't be able to get to work. They won't be able to shop for groceries. They will not be able to access medical care. Hospitals will begin to exhaust oxygen supplies. Within 2 weeks, the nation's clean water supply will begin to run dry. 4 weeks, the nation will exhaust its water supply, clean water supply, and water will be safe for drinking only after boiling. As a result, gastrointestinal illnesses will increase, further taxing an already weakened healthcare system. So you get the point. There are many, many things that could bring us to our knees in a matter of days. A matter of days. But there is one other thing that this beast power may use to bring us to our knees in another way that perhaps we haven't thought of. Bring us to our knees through something called the mark of the beast. The Sabbath has been a sign of God's people down through the ages. The Sabbath's always been a sign between God and his people, one of the most controversial commandments. People will say, oh, I'll keep the Ten Commandments. No, check that. I'll keep the Nine Commandments. People don't want to keep the Sabbath holy. It is one of the most controversial commandments that there is. The most attacked, the most compromised. However, we believe that in the future, very powerful and very deceitful men are going to attempt to force you into giving up the Sabbath. Would you do that? They're going to use cunning, twisted misinterpretations of the scriptures themselves to say the Sabbath has been done away. You need to worship on another day. And if you do not agree to do that willingly, they're going to attempt to force it on you now under penalty of death. What did we read earlier that happened to church people? What has happened through the ages? What's the cause of martyrdom through the ages? We need to understand exactly what's coming. A future powerful government is going to force its mark, its sign on humanity. Why? Revelation 13, verse 11. Revelation 13, verse 11. Why would they want to do these things? What's so important about it? It has to do with power and control. Verse 11, Revelation 13. I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, a false church, spoke like a dragon, and he exercises all the authority of the beast in his presence and causes the earth and all those who dwell in it. You talk about power. Look what we're reading here. He causes all the people of the earth to worship the first beast, to worship this government. The beast whose deadly wound was healed. Where's that coming from? That's our European superpower. He performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. Well, these are pretty amazing things. Look what he's able to do. He deceives those who dwell on the earth. How? By the signs that he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to this beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, so it's alive. that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship this image and his mark to be killed. He causes all, everybody, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, they will all receive this sign, this mark on their right hand, on their foreheads. Everyone will be doing it. Everybody will be forced to do it because this is for the greater good. And no one may buy or sell except one who has this mark or this name of the beast or the number of his name. So everybody is going to say, I want that mark. Give it to me. Because this is a sign of something great. This is a sign of world peace. You guys are bringing peace to the world. I want to be part of that. I want to be part of something that brings peace to the world. And you've solved all the problems of and obviously you're of God, because look at what you can do. You brought fire down from heaven. And you've brought peace to the Middle East. And you've taken away the threat of Islamic terrorism. We won't have any more 9/11s in this country anymore, because look what you're able to do. I want that mark. I want to be part of this. I thought Saturday was the Sabbath. Oh, I guess not, because look how powerful you are. Look what you've done. Look at world peace you've established. I'm going to church now with you. And by the way, if I don't, I die. How easy was it for people to give up the Sabbath a few years ago when they just said, no, it's done away. Oh, okay, it's done away. You give up the Sabbath or you die. Nobody will be able to buy or sell unless he receives this mark. Everyone wants to be able to buy or sell. You won't be able to earn a living. You won't be able to engage in commerce or business at all. The mark has a direct bearing on one's ability to hold a job or earn a living or engage in any way at all. If you don't have it, you have to have it if you want to live in this society. This great false church, it says, causes people. They have the power and the authority to cause it, them to receive the mark, and will prevent anybody else who doesn't have the mark from engaging in this business. A mark is a sign. Ezekiel 20, verse 12. Moreover, I gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between them and me, so that they might know that I am the Lord who sanctifies them. It will be a counterfeit sign, a counterfeit mark. This great false church has used this throughout history to enforce worshiping on Sunday instead of Saturday. And people have been put to death for Judaizing. And they use that word in such contempt. The mark will be enforced again. Perhaps because the blame for all the catastrophic events that's happened to this world by this time, all the problems, all the terrible things that we've been doing that's happened to us, maybe it's because we weren't keeping Sunday like we should have been. Maybe we were too lax. We shouldn't have been going to those football games on Sunday afternoon after all. We should have been in church. And authorities will now insist on this. If we hold fast to the Sabbath, though, we face martyrdom at the hands of this power. Who's going to have to face that? How can we be protected from that? Well, God has to know your heart, doesn't he? God has to know you. Will you keep his commandments or no? The Sabbath is a test command. Therefore, God will test us on the Sabbath because it is a test commandment. Have you proven the Sabbath? Are the Sabbath and the holy days precious to you? Do you keep the Sabbath holy? Do you remember the Sabbath? We show God by our heart and by our actions. We'll keep the Sabbath holy no matter what. And through our actions, not only in regards to the Sabbath day and to the holy days, but through our response, if you will, to all of God's commandments, we show God and we can stand before him and we can say, I've kept your word. I have not denied your name. I've stood fast. And that brings us to the point of the last prophecy that we'll cover today in Revelation 3 and verse 7. Revelation 3, verse 7. Familiar words for us. To the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things says he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts, shuts and no one opens. Notice this. I know your works. We cannot hide anything from God. He sees us. He watches. He evaluates. He tests. I know your works. I know your heart. See, I've set before you an open door. Are you going to walk through it? No man can shut it. You have a little strength. You've kept my word. You have not denied my name. Even though the opportunity was there, you held fast. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they're Jews, but they're not. They lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet someday. No, I have loved you. Because then that you have kept my command to persevere, God says this, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. We're being tested now, aren't we? Are we passing this test? A test is coming. Clearly, though, there is promise of protection from the hour of trial that is coming. And we believe this is talking about protection from the tribulation and the day of the Lord. Revelation 12, verse 12. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them, because the devil has been there. Now, woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath. He knows now at this time that his time is very short. Now Satan goes on an all-out attack. Who will he attack? It is not the everyday man on the street. His attack will be against the church of God. He knows he has a short time. I have to intensify my efforts. Now God tells us we are to try the spirits. Test the spirits. Or see if they are of God. Satan will be definitely stirring spirits up at this time. Great deception, it says, if they might deceive the very elect. We talked about that many times. Verse 13. When the dragon saw that he was cast to the earth, where does he take out his anger? It's not against the rest of the world. He persecutes the woman, the church of God, who gave birth to the male child, speaking of Jesus Christ. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle so that she might fly into her wilderness to her place. What's that mean? I don't know, and you don't either, but we'll find out. And she is nourished there for a time, times and a half a time, 3.5 years, from the presence of the serpent. From the dragon. And so the dragon is angry. He spews out water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. Now what's that going to be like? I don't know. What is that flood? Is it an army? Will it look like we're going to die? I think so. Will it be a test of faith? I think so. What happened to the ancient Israelites? Armies were chasing them. Satan, Pharaoh, you know, chasing after them. The church in the wilderness, if you will. And here's Pharaoh's armies. Going to descend on them and chase them. And there's the sea and there's the mountains. I'm stuck. I'm going to die. Something unexpected happened. The Red Sea opens up and they walk through that. And I didn't expect that at all, did they? What does it say here? But the earth helps the woman. And the earth opens its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon has spewed out of his mouth. Now that's unexpected. It shouldn't be. We're just reading about it. How often have you read that verse? How often have you considered what that might be like? Expect it. Expect something unexpected. And so the dragon sees, well, she's being protected. There's nothing I can do. The dragon now is enraged still with the church, with the woman. And he now goes to make war with the rest of her offspring, who are church people. They keep the commandments of God. They have the testimony of Jesus Christ. The church flies to the wilderness, it says, in some way, to be nourished from the face of the serpent. He cast out this water as a flood. The earth helps the woman. The dragon is angry. goes to make war with others not in this place. They are a commandment-keeping group of people. They are the church of God. They have the testimony of Jesus Christ. They are not Jews because the Jews deny Jesus Christ. They are left back for whatever reason. They are lukewarm, might we say, who have to go through this tribulation period. Their gold has not yet been tried and tested in the fire enough. They haven't shown themselves to God yet. Not zealous, apparently lacking in the attitude maybe of brotherly love. Themes that we used to emphasize much stronger in the church, and perhaps we should now. Now, we don't want to be known as a religion of fear religion. We don't have these sermons on prophecy to make you tremble and afraid and say, woe is me, these terrible things are going to happen. We don't ever want to be afraid of God. We don't emphasize that if you don't do all the right things now, God's going to have you tortured to death. You better straighten up. What is our emphasis? What's our correct emphasis in the first place? We obey God from the heart because we love God. We love His way of life. And no matter what, we'll always do it because it's part of us. It's who we are. We don't have to have these threats over us or anything about it, even if it doesn't. Even if we knew time was going to go on another 500 years, we have the same zeal and the same passion for God's way of life, no matter what. Still, these things are here. People want to know where it is. Where's the place of safety? We don't know. Many of you know that they thought the location would be in Petra. Where? In Jordan. Why did we talk about that earlier? Jordan's been mentioned throughout the decades of the church. Nothing in the Bible expressly says, although you can get an indication that it might be. There are certain clues. We've talked about that in a Bible study a year or two back. What the clues are that show if the Bible tells us a place, then Petra may be the place. Doesn't make any difference. Petra today is a tourist attraction. Hotels, restaurants, there's a modern city right outside the entrance to the Sikh. It's called Wadi Musa. You can go there and have a vacation. It's the number one tourist spot in the entire nation of Jordan. Good restaurant inside as well. As you're going through, you know, looking at all the temple and all that stuff, and you get hungry and thirsty while you go spend your money in the restaurant. Is that it? I don't know, but if I was going to give a reason why it might be, it would be because of the continued relationship that we've had with Jordan through all these years. The favor that we've had with the royal family for all these years that continues to this day. Doesn't matter. What matters is our personal relationship with God in the first place. He'll take care of the details, won't He? He'll take care of the details. You know, we might go to our place of safety tonight. You ever think of that? So we better be spiritually ready all the time. But Luke 21:36 tells us, watch and pray so that we may be accounted worthy to escape. So we are being judged. There is judgment upon us. God's not overly demanding, but He is watching us. He is judging our actions. What are your fruits? What are you doing? God has His criteria for all of us. I mean, He wants us to be like Him. We're developing godly character. We're developing the fruits of the Spirit. How are we doing on all these things? God has to know our hearts. And I believe God has to know our commitments, especially to the Sabbath and to the holy days. Of course, all of the law of God. And so time is up. And we'll conclude part two of this sermon series on prophecy. We've got a couple more to go on. We've got to go through yet the day of the Lord, the 144,000, an innumerable multitude, and the silence in heaven for the space of 1 hour. But for now, we'll take a 10-minute break after the services, and we'll have the Bible study after we have our final hymn.